Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You will hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and industry leaders on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today I'll be taking time to speak with Director of Immigration and Trade Policy at the American Action Forum, Jackie Veris, and the Concord Coalition's Executive Director, Bob Bixby. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. Democratic leaders in the House pulled their fiscal year 2020 legislative branch spending bill from a nearly $1 trillion five-bill spending package that is currently being put together. They did it to avoid a contentious fight over a congressional pay raise. Lawmakers have been denied a cost of living increase since 2009, and that could continue into 2020. That large appropriations bill package also includes a provision aimed at providing back pay for federal contractors that were furloughed during the most recent partial government shutdown. While Congress typically provides back pay to federal employees who are furloughed or forced to work without pay during a shutdown, contractors haven't usually received such benefits. The strategy to bundle the bills is to help speed the budget process along and avoid another shutdown. However, it's no silver bullet. Talks are at least underway to raise discretionary spending caps imposed under a 2011 deficit reduction law. Failure to make a deal could bring the process to a halt. The Senate, which has been waiting on its appropriations process until new spending limits are set, may not wait much longer. It may actually start drafting bills based on a, quote, deemed overall spending limit and simply adjust the numbers later whenever a bipartisan agreement emerges. The Democratic Blue Dog Coalition in the House is increasing pressure on party leadership to curb deficit spending. It sent a letter urging leaders to, quote, keep our fiscal house in order by abiding by PAYGO rules, which require any new tax cuts or spending increases to be offset by cuts to other programs or revenue raisers to avoid increasing the deficit. Challenges to their stance will be coming soon, as there's a variety of proposed legislation bearing hefty price tags currently working through the House. Up next, Bob Bixby will join me to discuss the Concord Coalition's new fiscally responsible economic growth agenda. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show by the Concord Coalition's Executive Director, Bob Bixby. Bob, you know very well. He's a regular contributor on the show. Welcome back.
Good to be back with you, Chase.
Always a pleasure to talk to our Executive Director. And I wanted to have you on as the first segment today to sort of give a lay of the land of a broad initiative that the Concord Coalition is currently working on, because in our later segment, we're going to talk about one of the reports or papers that was just recently published as a part of that initiative focused on immigration. So I know the Concord Coalition is going to be working on a fiscally responsible economic growth agenda. But for our listeners, could you tell them what that is, what it means, and what to expect over the course of the next year?
Well, I'm very excited about this. You know, when the Concord Coalition was created, the focus was on being a almost like being an economic growth project. I mean, Paul Tsongas and Warren Rudman and Pete Peterson talked a lot about how it was important to do the things that we needed to do as a nation to keep the economy strong and growing economically. And an important part of that was fiscal responsibility, because you can't have a strong, growing economy that's built on a mountain of debt. And so getting our fiscal house in order has always been a main policy focus, the main policy focus, really, of the Concord Coalition. But it's in pursuit of a larger aim, which is a sustainable, growing economy that will benefit future generations. So it's not just a focus on, you know, let's cut spending and raise taxes because we're obsessed with a balanced budget or something like that. It's always had a broader economic objective tied to it.
So, Bob, why is it important now to talk about a sustainable economic growth agenda? I mean, we're at a current point where the economy is growing at about 3%, and long-term projections are around 2%. So, you know, for the average listener, that might sound pretty good. So why might it not be good, and why is it important to have this conversation now?
Well, for one thing, the fiscal outlook remains as unsustainable as it ever was, with debt going over 100% of GDP and higher. So the fiscal outlook is actually so bad that it is a drain on the economic outlook. But the other element of this is the changing demographics in the country, with the slowing workforce growth. That has a limiting effect on the size of the economy, because there are not fewer workers in numbers, but I mean the growth of the labor force is much slower, and that affects the potential growth of the economy. Productivity is slowed as well, and that may also have something to do with the changing demographics in the country. So, you know, like you said, a 2% projected economic growth, that's a lot lower than the 3% that we used to take for granted is kind of the standard economic growth. And if you adjust downward the economy by that much, by about a third of the growth that it has been, that's a lot. That's a substantial drain on the living standards of future generations. So what we did with this project is to say, well, what steps could we take to get our fiscal house in order and treat the symptoms of the slowing economy, which have to do with workforce growth and productivity? So we came up with five topics. Would you like to hear them?
You know I would.
Okay, well, so the five topics are healthcare reform, Social Security solvency, legal immigration reform, workforce training, and research and development.
And before we get into too much detail on those, I just want to remind our listeners who we're talking to. This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm talking to Bob Bixby, Concord's Executive Director, and we're starting to go into detail a little bit more on the fiscally responsible economic growth agenda. It's a project that Concord is currently working on. And Bob, you just mentioned the five topics that this project will focus on or emphasize. Are there going to be reports or studies or events focused on these topics, and why is it important to address them now?
Well, there's going to be a paper on each, and we've recruited some scholars from some of the top think tanks in Washington, and those papers will be slowly rolled out over the next few months and packaged together as this fiscally responsible economic growth agenda. And what it's trying to do is look both at bringing the federal budget to a sustainable path, and that means reducing deficits and trying to get the debt stabilized or lowered, and then looking at ways to address the slow economic projections going forward, which means things that would increase the size of the labor force and increase the productivity of the labor force, which is why we get into areas like legal immigration and R&D spending and workforce training. Those are areas that are changing, the workforce is changing quite a bit, and so people are going to need lifelong learning skills, people are going to need to be retrained. It's not the sort of model of the past of, you know, go to college, get a four-year liberal arts degree, and go out and get a job. Or, if not a college career, then to, you know, get a job shortly out of high school and stick with that trade or profession for you know, the rest of your career. Things are just going to, you know, be changing so much that we need to look at how workforce training is done. But we also need to look at what the federal government does with research and development, which really has been getting squeezed over the years. You don't notice it so much, but we used to spend a lot more as a percentage of our economy, as a percentage of the budget, on research and development. And so there are opportunities for the federal government to do more there to help with productivity. And the legal immigration piece, which was part of a paper that was just released at the end of May, is about enhancing the growth of the workforce and shifting the focus of the immigration system more towards an economics-based goal rather than simply family-based. Family considerations are important, but we have an opportunity to use the legal immigration system to help with economic growth. So those things, those five topics are what we're going to be concentrating on.
And Bob, you mentioned that two of the primary goals here are, at least from what I thought I heard you say, was improving fiscal responsibility and long-term economic growth by focusing on reform in these five areas: healthcare, Social Security, legal immigration, workforce training and investment, as well as research and development. Do you set any broad benchmarks or goals in how these five topics might tie together? So just as an example, the Congressional Budget Office has put out reports on what it would take to level off the debt-to-GDP ratio or achieve a certain deficit level for each year as a percentage of the economy. Do you set any benchmarks like that, or is this more about focusing the conversation on some of these long-term objectives?
I think the important thing first is to set the agenda on these benchmarks rather than setting a particular goal at the moment. But as the project develops, I do think that that's a refinement that you'd want to look at, is to see if you adopted some of these proposals that the authors are going to make, how would it come out in terms of stabilizing the debt-to-GDP ratio, or how much would it actually enhance economic growth. But for the first thing is, let's see if we can get the conversation going in the right direction on those things. And I should point out that it's not like these are the only five things we need to worry about. I think we need to worry about further efforts to address the tax code to make it more efficient. I think we're going to need to bring in more revenues as the demographics change and healthcare costs continue to rise. So we have challenges there. I think the trade is an issue that one would need to look at in terms of long-term economic growth, possibly regulatory reform. There are a lot of things that are in a pro-growth agenda, but we wanted to start with these five topics because we think they're really fundamental. Healthcare is the most important programmatic challenge. Social Security is the largest federal program, and it's out of whack over the long term, so we need to bring it into focus. And then when you look at the workforce and the workforce productivity, those are things that are really holding back economic growth right now. It's important to address those topics front and center and get a good conversation going on what it would really take to get economic growth back to the levels that we used to have back even 20 years ago, 15 years ago.
And speaking of what it would take, Bob, let's use the immigration report or study as an example. Are the ideas or proposals within some of these studies, are they focused on bipartisan reform? Are they politically feasible? Like, when you see this package of ideas and you see it as sort of foundational to improving long-term economic growth and fiscal responsibility, how likely do you think it is that they'll actually be acted upon in Congress?
Well, you can't look at the current Congress and think that anything is likely to happen aside from continued gridlock.
All right, fair enough.
So, let alone, ambitious ideas. But one thing that we're going to try to do with this project is reach out to new leaders. We certainly want the current leaders to be aware of the ideas that come out of this project. But I think it's an opportunity to look at emerging up-and-coming leaders, people who may be at the state and local level right now, or maybe not even thinking about politics at all, that might get into it later, who really have an interest in public policy and would like to solve some of these problems, and would really be interested in hearing about an agenda. So it's really a nonpartisan thing. The folks that have been contributing to these papers are from a diverse group of think tanks, and they're some are Democrats and some are Republicans. So the focus is not to be bipartisan per se, but to be nonpartisan. It's just, let's come up with some ideas and see what the reaction is. Ideas that we think will address the problems. And if others have other ideas, that's fine too. Put them on the table. But we think that these are the things that we ought to be talking about.
Well, that sounds like it goes to the very core of what Concord does and why we do it, especially the concept of everything should be on the table in discussions like this. It probably doesn't hurt. That's also the New Hampshire primary and election year. So in terms of young or new leaders that might have interest in this particular initiative or effort, I think it's good timing. This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me and Bob Bixby discuss Concord's new fiscally responsible economic growth agenda and the effort ongoing this year and the papers that will come out on a variety of topics. Thank you for joining the show, Bob.
You're welcome.
We'll be back after these short messages with Bob again and Jackie Veris of the American Action Forum to discuss immigration and trade. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by Bob Bixby and Jackie Veris. Bob, you know well. He's a regular contributor on the show and the Concord Coalition's executive director. Jackie is the director of immigration and trade policy at the American Action Forum. Her research focuses on the economic and employment implications of both immigration and trade, including the cost of tariffs and non-tariff barriers, the economic contributions of foreign-born workers, and fiscal implications of the DACA program. Her work also examines the general impacts of immigration and trade on business, workers, productivity, consumer prices, and the macro economy. Jackie's research has been highlighted in many prominent national media outlets. She received her master's in applied economics at Johns Hopkins, a bachelor's in economics, and a bachelor's in political science from the University of Florida. Welcome to Facing the Future, Bob and Jackie.
Thanks.
Yeah, thank you very much.
We're happy to have you on the show to discuss a pretty important topic. And what prompted having you for today's Facing the Future, Jackie, was a report that was put out by AAF called Building a Pro-Growth Legal Immigration System. And you had an op-ed that was published in the Des Moines Register last week discussing that report a bit. And it also ties into a broader effort that the Concord Coalition is involved with. So maybe before we jump into the findings and research of that report, you can give a quick summary, Jackie, of what the immigration system looks like right now, what economic growth projections look like, and why it was important to have this kind of conversation.
Absolutely. The immigration system we have today was primarily established in 1965. So it's been a long time since any sort of major reform was done. It was established on the basis of family reunification. So over two-thirds of the current green cards we give out now are to the family members of U.S. citizens or legal permanent residents. If you compare that to our peer nations like Australia and Canada, their dynamic is flipped. So about two-thirds of their permanent visas being given out are for economic reasons. In the United States, the employment-based immigration system, economic-based immigration system, was really an afterthought. So what this report and is addressing is an idea of rethinking immigration to be a tool of economic growth.
Jackie, why is it important right now to rethink immigration? Are we having issues in long-term economic growth or workforce productivity? What are the primary motivators for having a discussion on reforming our legal immigration system?
Really, it's two parts. So on one hand, you do see a general dissatisfaction growing with our current legal immigration system. That's on both the individual and employer side. So for individuals trying to come to the United States legally, they can wait up to 20 years after being accepted, after their application is accepted, before they're even allowed to step foot in the United States. On the employer side, they're having a very hard time getting access to the workers that they need because of our limits on legal immigration is just lower than what we need as a country. And then the other piece to it is our economic reality. We're experiencing significant labor shortages. It is impacting economic growth. So with the last job numbers you see in May, at least for the ADP report, they cited labor shortages as one of the main reasons why the job numbers were so low. So immigration really is a solution to the problems we're facing, not to mention the demographic challenges we have coming up with the retiring baby boomers.
So, Jackie, it sounds like economic growth is a primary motivator for some of the reforms that are offered in this report relative to what the system currently focuses on. So maybe it's a good time to get a quick recap of what the report put out there in terms of potential solutions or a way to revamp the system to have a more long-term focus as it pertains to our workforce and economic growth.
So what we did here at the American Action Forum as a think tank, we started thinking, how can we create a better immigration system for all parties involved that would benefit our economy? So to do that, we did look to those other nations with point systems and see how we could adapt a point system here that could help us identify immigrants with desirable characteristics that are best suited to be able to assimilate and contribute to our economy. So basically, what we came up with is a point system that is focused on two types of people. So both the high-skilled, highly educated folks, so you can think a PhD in technology or information systems, those people, there's no disagreement about that we should be welcoming them here and trying to attract them, the best and the brightest, as people call them. But on the flip side, you know, the United States is creating high-paying jobs in tech and information systems that Americans are gravitating towards, leaving the lower-skilled side of things mainly empty. So some of the greatest labor shortages we're seeing are in low-skilled occupations like agriculture and construction. So we also wanted to build in an avenue for people with those specific skills to be able to come into the United States and fill some of those labor shortages. So through the point system, if you are someone who does not have, let's say, a bachelor's degree, or even someone who doesn't necessarily speak English, you can come to the United States on a temporary worker visa, work for a period of 6 years, prove your economic contributions and your labor market value, and then be given a points bump that, given other factors, would qualify you for entry. So that's how we thought about it.
And Jackie, just to piggyback off the discussion on the point system, what other countries use that type of model, and is it a huge variation from the constructs within the current system? Like, do we use a point system at all right now, and how big of a change would that be for us?
Right now, there are no point systems in the United States. Basically, the way it works is that if you are an immediate family member, so a spouse or a minor child to a U.S. citizen, you are guaranteed entry with no limitations. So that's where we see the bulk of our immigration coming from. The rest of kind of the majority are family members that are not immediate. So you can think parents or siblings or the children of siblings. And there's no other qualifications other than that family relationship. Like I said, the employment, the economic part of our immigration system was an afterthought. So by design, the proportion of immigrants coming in for economic reasons really can't exceed more than 12, 13, 14% of total green cards granted. And when you look at green cards granted to new entrants, that's less than 5%. So in the other countries we examined, which were Australia and Canada, their point systems reward things like education, English language ability, the types of work that you do, and they focus much more on individuals well-equipped to contribute to their economy and less on family relationships. Now, I'm not saying that family relationships aren't important. They should be honored, and people should be given favorability for having those family relationships. We just wanted to shift the focus away from a purely family-based system to one that best sets up our economy to be able to succeed in the future.
Jackie, what would be some of the numbers and figures here in how the immigration system would change? So if we would shift from a family-focused immigration system to an economic-focused immigration system, would you see a sharp decrease in the number of family members or relatives coming in through our immigration system, or do you see more of just a larger, broader number of immigrants coming into the country and trying to get that economic focus more on an equal playing field?
One of the more innovative parts of our design, in my opinion, is that we do not put a cap on legal immigration. We say that the number of immigrants should be equal to the number of qualified applicants. So I don't expect to see any drop-off in immigration levels. Also with that, though, it's impossible to predict how many people would apply and would qualify under the point system. And another part of what we're trying to do here, we're not trying to limit family immigration or lessen it. We just want to make economic immigration a higher priority and a higher focus for the United States.
This is Bob. Let me jump in on another question, another aspect of this from a economic growth perspective. We talked about the demographic changes where the United States has a slowing rate of growth of the workforce, and so immigration can help address that. Another part of that is productivity. Workers in the future will need to be more productive as the demographics change. And is there some economic evidence to suggest that immigration is also helpful on productivity?
Absolutely. Immigration, through academic literature, through research, has been shown to increase U.S. productivity. And why that is, it's really twofold. So you have immigrants coming and starting new businesses. They have higher rates of business creation than natives. They also have higher rates of longer work hours. They have a huge presence in the Fortune 500 companies. I believe it's 40% of current Fortune 500 companies were founded by either immigrants or children of immigrants. So they increase productivity on the high-skilled side. And then on the low-skilled side, you see immigrants gravitating toward different types of work than U.S.-born people. And by doing that, you have labor specialization. You make it easier for people to do the jobs that they can well, and that increases productivity as well. And just one last thing to point out that a lot of people don't think about. Immigration itself, by bringing new people here, you're increasing demand for things at the grocery store. You're increasing demand for housing. That creates jobs just by increasing the population of the United States.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking to Bob Bixby and Jackie Varis. We're discussing immigration reform and a proposal issued by the American Action Forum in coordination with a broader project for the Concord Coalition. And Jackie, I wanted to pick up on the topic you were just discussing, reforms to our legal immigration system. Are they focused on permanent residency, a path to full-blown citizenship, or really is an expansion of, say, work visas? What's sort of the ultimate goal here?
With our report, we made an intentional decision not to focus on the undocumented population, not to focus on DACA, not to focus on the diversity lottery, but simply the core visa granting system of the United States. And that is only applying to legal permanent residents, so green cards. There is a lot of research and surveys being done shown that temporary visas, while beneficial for seasonal work, just provide a lot of uncertainty for the employers that are looking for a consistent labor force. So changing the way we give out green cards, in my opinion, is really the best way to improve our business climate.
And you mentioned earlier that you're not really focused on setting caps in this particular plan. Are there any other limits within the proposal or perhaps any foreseeable downsides or potential negative consequences to some of these ideas?
So the reason we didn't focus on some of those other types of immigration is because we wanted to present an idea for something that there's already a lot of agreement on. So somewhere to start. Both Democrats and Republicans agree on the notion that we should have an immigration system that benefits our economy. So in terms of downsides to the proposal, I mean, I see some political maybe hurdles to overcome with not imposing a limit on legal immigration, but this was meant to be a gold standard. If us from an economically minded position were to dream up an immigration system that would benefit our economy, workers, consumers, businesses, everyone, this is what it is. From this, then, of course, you have to start considering political considerations. But this is where we wanted to start it off at.
And, of course, this isn't related to the border security issue. Border security is very, very important and can be handled separately from this issue, which is about the legal immigration system and what criteria guide that process.
Yes, I'd say with immigration, picking the immigrants that we want to allow entry into our country, it's a very important decision. And it also is picking what the future of America is. These people are going to integrate into our society. They're going to have children and grandchildren here. So why not be a bit more intentional about choosing America's future?
It's an increasingly global workforce, and we need to be competitive with other countries that want to accept highly skilled immigrants and those that would like to come here. It seems logical that we, since we need them and they want to come here, that it would help our economy to let them in.
And Jackie, can you get a little more in detail? I think I read in the report that you felt the proposals being put out there would be pretty responsive to any economic challenges, either on a national or a global scale. Can you break that down a little bit as to why that might be?
So as a part of our design, we wanted to build in flexibility. The economy today looks nothing like it did 30 years ago, and it looks nothing like it will in another 30 years. So to do that, we allowed for favorability in this design, basically bonus points, so additional points awarded to individuals in high-demand occupations, either at a national or local level. And that will change, and it should change. So we awarded points both to, let's say, the Department of Labor to be able to say, we need more mechanical engineers this year, for instance. So anyone with a mechanical engineering background would be given bonus points on their application. And then at the local level, we awarded these bonus points to governors of different states. So whether you're in Iowa and you recognize a need for more biochemists and agricultural sciences, or you're in Maryland and you recognize the need for crab pickers, we wanted to build in that flexibility and allow it to be able to change over time to kind of adapt with the changing economy.
And I have sort of two questions that come out of that topic a bit, and that gets back to the political/economic realities of some of these ideas. And you mentioned earlier some of the pitfalls in the immigration discussion, and Bob, you talked about one too when it came to border security. And one of the larger complaints that you hear, and whether it's true or not, in this discussion is that immigrants are taking American citizen jobs. So do you think that this plan can sidestep that kind of landmine, or is there even any truth to that allegation?
If you look in the research, like I said earlier, immigration is a net positive for the economy. You know, as with anything, whether it be opening up to global trade or opening up to immigration, you're going to have shifts in the labor market as we become more productive. So for instance, the United States, we are a services economy. We are great at information systems, at services, at tech. And you've seen that shift in the labor market as we've become more specialized after opening up to global trade. The same thing with immigration. As more people come in that are specialized in different things, you will see a labor market shift. However, if in the research, the only area that is really a net negative for the native-born population are people with less than high school degrees, so on the lower-skilled side, and then also previous immigrants. Those two groups of people are in the most direct labor market competition with immigrants on the low-skilled side. So you are going to see a little bit of displacement, but like I said, with an increase in people coming into the economy and an increase in spending and economic growth, that's going to generate new jobs. So we as a country just need to be a little bit more mindful at preparing individuals for those transitions. But on that, so yes, of course, there will be, you'll hear some of that criticism, but the evidence for it is not as pronounced as you will hear people saying.
And you rolled into my second question pretty nicely there. I wanted to get into the shifts in the labor market and what almost the transformation we're seeing in the workforce and in different industries, and how there's a movement towards automation and more robotics-oriented manufacturing. So in this proposal, did you factor in those sort of changes? Will we have the same labor force demands, even though many industries are moving to more of a robotic automation focus?
Yeah, so automation is a great new development across the world. It's improving our ability to increase our output, and there's such great advancements that we're seeing. It is and will have a labor market impact. In my opinion, some of the estimates of what that impact may be are a little bit overblown, because we're not in an economy that is stagnant, right? So our economy survived the Industrial Revolution. It changed from largely one based on agriculture to largely one based on services. And I don't expect those changes to stop anytime soon. So how we design this immigration system is more focused on the qualifications of the individuals, allowing them to be able to have free labor mobility and contribute to the economy in the best way that they can. That flexibility will be able to help deal with any of those coming labor market changes that we'll see. But like I said, I'm an optimist. I don't think that all of our jobs are going to be given to robots. The United States has one of the best economies in the world, and I don't think that's going to change.
And my last question before I want to switch gears to your other area of expertise, and that is trade. In this proposal, do you see any impact or effect on some of our existing systems like Social Security or Medicare or investment in education, any new costs related to an influx in immigration like this?
What the research shows is that immigrants, when they first come, because they have higher birth rates than people born in the United States, there is an additional cost at the state and local level, primarily due to education. However, as they grow older, they end up using less Social Security benefits than someone born in the United States. So I don't foresee any significant changes. If anything, the boost to economic growth will be something that allows for more tax revenue, a healthier economy, and an overall benefit to the United States.
And one thing that would happen initially with more immigrants coming in is that they would pay payroll taxes, and that would help the short-term shortfalls with, say, programs like Social Security and Medicare, which are running cash deficits. However, like anybody else, immigrants get older, and they would qualify for benefits, and so it's not a cure. You can't say that legal immigration is a cure for our longer-term problems in those programs like Social Security and Medicare. It would provide a short-term infusion of cash, but of course, over the longer term, they would qualify for benefits as well.
So I want to move the conversation to trade. It's a relatively hot topic right now in the news, especially with this back and forth on tariffs. So Jackie, can you give us a glimpse of what it's like right now in international trade climate, and what's been happening recently with tariffs?
As you said, my other job is in trade, and it is never boring, I'll tell you that. So President Trump has been very active when it comes to changing U.S. trade policy, and his favorite tool to use has been tariffs. So since he entered office, we've placed tariffs on steel and aluminum imports from just about everywhere, and we've placed a heck of a lot of tariffs on China. So as of right now, we have tariffs on currently $280 billion worth of U.S. imports, the majority of that being on goods from China. The thing that maybe gets lost in the conversation is that not only are these tariffs increasing prices for U.S. consumers, because a tariff is a tax on a good that we buy that's just not made in the United States, but it's also increasing the cost for businesses. Over half of all imports are used by U.S. businesses in domestic production. So tariffs actually make it harder and more expensive to manufacture things here in America.
And what's been, if any, the economic impact of this $280 billion in tariffs? Because there's also discussion of packages of funding going to specific industries to help offset the cost of that. So is it a bit of a wash, or has there been an actual economic impact of this? I guess I'll call it a trade war, but you can tell me if we're actually in one.
There definitely is a cost to it. So you see it, like I said, in two ways. It either increases the cost of the good that you're buying, or it increases the manufacturing cost for U.S. producers that then have to either decide whether to increase their prices, or if they just can't because of where consumers are at, they will then decrease investment. So I've seen decreases in capital expenditures, decreases in future hiring plans. And all in all, when you look at the president's tariffs, in aggregate, they're increasing economy-wide costs by about $70 billion per year. And then if he moves forward with his plans to increase tariffs even more on China, that will add an additional $70 billion cost per year to the U.S. economy. So it is definitely having significant impacts, and businesses are feeling the pain.
And when you're looking back at history, are we in a more volatile time than in recent decades when it comes to this sort of international trade and tariff climate? And is there any kind of long-term ripple effect on the economy when you go through a period like this?
Well, I'll tell you this. So President Trump has been using rarely before utilized mechanisms in law in order to have the legal justification to apply these tariffs unilaterally. Trade policy is one of the areas that the president has enormous authority over. So with a stroke of a pen, he can increase tariffs by 25% on any country he chooses. It is in resulting in volatility. Every tariff that the president has imposed has resulted in dollar-for-dollar retaliation by our trading partners. So not only are U.S. imports becoming more expensive, but U.S. exporters are facing new trade barriers in the markets that they've come to depend on. So I'd say, to answer your question, I'd say we've been in a trade war for quite a while.
And let me just say something about the revenue effect of the tariff, because that's become an issue, too. With the budget deficit, some in the administration have said, well, the tariffs are helping to close the budget gap. But it's important to realize that tariff income is really a very, very small part of the federal revenue picture. So, for example, in 2018, we took in $41 billion in customs and duties. And in 2019, CBO projects that that's going to go up almost double, to over $70 billion. Approaching $80 billion. And so revenues, tariffs have actually been up like 78% this year. But we're talking about a fairly small number in the grand scheme of things. $70 billion is a lot of money. I'd like to have it in my checking account. But in the $4 trillion or so federal budget, it's very, very small. Look, the CBO is projecting a grand total of like $921 billion in customs revenue over the next 10 years, and that's almost the exact amount of interest cost on the debt alone in 1 year within 10 years. So, look, let's not get carried away with this being a big revenue gusher.
I'd like to add one more thing to that. So you hear the president talking about tariff revenue. I don't think people realize who pays for the tariff. So a tariff is something that a U.S. business has to pay on an import. It is a tax on our consumption. So we may be bringing in more revenue, but like Bob said, not nearly enough to do any sort of meaningful closing of our current deficit. But it's at the cost of U.S. consumers and U.S. businesses. China is not the one paying for these tariffs. We are.
This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and you've been listening to me, Bob Bixby, and Jackie Varis. We discussed immigration reform, trade, and tariffs. Thank you both for joining the show.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much.
You've been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.